Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Hilotecha, which means you shall set up. This is Numbers from chapter 8 through Numbers chapter 12, verse 16. Numbers chapter 8. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron, and say to him, when you kindle the lamps, toward the face of the menorah shall the seven lamps be cast their light." Aaron did so. Toward the face of the menorah he kindles those lamps, as the Lord commanded Moses. This is the workmanship of the menorah, hammered out gold from its base to its flower. It is hammered out, according to the vision the Lord showed Moses. So did he make the menorah. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the Levites from among the children of Israel and purify them. So shall you do to them to purify them. Sprinkle upon them water of purification. Let them pass a razor over their entire flesh, and let them immerse their garments. They should become pure. He shall take a young bull and its meal offering, fine flour mixed with oil, and a second young bull shall you take as a sin offering. You shall bring the Levites before the tent of the meeting, and you shall gather together the entire assembly of the children of Israel. You shall bring the Levites before the Lord, and the children of Israel shall lean their hands upon the Levites. Aaron shall wave the Levites as a wave service before the Lord from the children of Israel, and they shall remain to perform the service of the Lord. The Levites shall lean their hands upon the head of the bulls. You shall make one a sin offering and one a burnt offering to the Lord, to provide atonement for the Levites. You shall stand the Levites before Aaron, before his sons, and wave them as a wave service for the Lord. So shall you separate the Levites from among the children of Israel, and the Levites shall remain mine. Thereafter, the Levites shall come to serve the tent of meeting. You shall purify them, you shall wave them as a wave service, for presented are they to me from among the children of Israel, in place of the first issue of every womb. The firstborn of every one of the children of Israel have I taken them to myself. For every firstborn of the children of Israel became mine, of man and of livestock, on the day I struck every firstborn in the land of Egypt. I sanctified them for myself. I took the Levites in place of every firstborn among the children of Israel. Then I assigned the Levites to be presented to Aaron and his sons from among the children of Israel to perform the service of the children of Israel in the tent of meeting, and to provide atonement for the children of Israel, so that there will not be a plague among the children of Israel when the children of Israel approach the sanctuary." Moses and Aaron and the entire assembly of the children of Israel did to the Levites according to everything that the Lord commanded Moses about the Levites. So did the children of Israel do to them. The Levites purified themselves and immersed their garments, and Aaron waved them as a wave service before the Lord, and Aaron provided atonement for them to purify them. Afterwards, the Levites came to perform the service of the tent of meeting before Aaron and before his sons. Just as the Lord had commanded Moses concerning the Levites, so they did for them. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "This shall apply to Levites. From 25 years of age and up, he shall join the legion of the service, the tent of meeting. From 50 years of age, he shall withdraw from the legion of work and no longer work. He shall minister with his brethren in the tent of meeting to safeguard the charge, but work shall he not do. So shall you do to Levites concerning their charge." Chapter 9. Just for that. Sort of. Semi. Chapter 9. The Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the second year from their exodus to the land of Egypt in the first month, saying, "The children of Israel shall make the Pesach offering in its appointed time. On the 14th day of this month in the afternoon shall you make it, in its appointed time. According to all its decrees and laws shall you make it." Moses spoke to the children of Israel, to make the Pesach offering. They made the Pesach offering in the first month on the 14th day of the month in the afternoon in the wilderness of Sinai, according to everything the Lord had commanded Moses. So the children of Israel did. Now there were men who had been contaminated by a human corpse and could not make the Pesach offering on that day. So they approached Moses and Aaron on that day. Those men said to him, "We are contaminated through a human corpse. Why should we be diminished by not offering the Lord's offering in its appointed time among the rest of the children of Israel?" Moses said to them, "Stand by and I will hear what the Lord will command you." The Lord spoke to Moses saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, saying, if any man will become contaminated through a human corpse or be on a distant road, whether you or your generations, he shall make the Pesach offering for the Lord. In the second month, on the 14th day, in the afternoon, shall he make it. With matzot and bitter herbs shall they eat it. They shall not leave over from it until morning, nor shall they break a bone of it. Like all the decrees, the Pesach offering shall they make it. But a man who is pure and was not on the road and had refrained from making the Pesach offering, that soul should be cut off from its people, for he had not offered the Lord's offering at its appointed time. That man will bear his sin. When a convert shall dwell with you, and he shall make the Pesach offering to the Lord, according to the decree of the Pesach offering and its laws, so shall he do. One decree shall be for you, for the proselyte and the natives of the land. On the day the tabernacle was set up, the cloud covered the tabernacle that was a tent for the testimony. And in the evening, there would be upon the tabernacle like a fiery appearance all the way until morning. So it would always be, the cloud would cover it and an appearance of fire at night. And whenever the cloud was lifted up from atop the tent, afterwards children of Israel would journey. And in the place where the cloud would rest, there the children of Israel would encamp. According to the word of the Lord, would the children of Israel journey. According to the word of the Lord, would they encamp. All the days the cloud would rest upon the tabernacle, they would encamp. When the cloud lingered upon the tabernacle many days, the children of Israel would maintain the charge of the Lord and would not journey. Sometimes the cloud would be upon the tabernacle for a number of days. According to the word of the Lord, would they encamp, and according to the word of the Lord, would they journey. Sometimes the cloud would remain from evening until morning, and the cloud would be lifted up in the morning, and they would journey. For a day and a night, and the cloud would be lifted up, and they would journey. Or for 2 days, or for a month, or for a year, when the cloud would linger over the tabernacle resting upon it, the children of Israel would encamp, and would not journey. But when it was lifted up, they would journey. According to the word of the Lord, would they encamp, but according to the word of the Lord, would they journey. The charge of the Lord would they safeguard, according to the word of the Lord, through Moses. Chapter 10. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Make for yourselves 2 silver trumpets. Make them out of hammered work. They should be yours for summoning of the assembly and to cause the camps to journey. When they sound a long blast with them, the entire assembly shall assemble to you, to the entrance of the tent of meeting. If they sound a long blast with one, the leaders shall assemble to you, the head of the Israel's households, thousands. When you sound short blasts, the camps resting to the east shall journey. When you sound short blasts a second time, the camps resting to the south shall journey. Short blasts shall they sound for their journeys. When you gather together the congregation, you shall sound a long blast, but not a short blast. The sons of Aaron, the Kohen, shall sound the trumpets, and it shall be for you an eternal decree for your generations. When you go to wage war in your land against the enemy who oppresses you, you shall sound the short blast, the trumpets, and you shall be recalled before the Lord, your God, and you shall be saved from your foes. On a day of your gladness, and on your festivals, and on your new moons, you shall sound the trumpets over your burnt offerings, over your peace offerings. They shall be a remembrance for you before your God. I am the Lord your God. It was in the second year, in the second month, on the 20th day of the month, the cloud was lifted from upon the tabernacle of the testimony. The children of Israel journeyed. On their journeys from the wilderness of Sinai, Then the cloud rested in the wilderness of Paran. They journeyed for the first time at the bidding of the Lord through Moses. The banner of the camp of the children of Judah journeyed first according to legions. Over its legion was Nahshon, the son of Abinadab. Over the legion of the tribe of the children of Issachar was Nethanel, son of Zuar. Over the legion of the tribe of the children of Zebulun was Eliab, son of Helon. The tabernacle was then taken down. Then journeyed the sons of Gershon and the sons of Merari, the bearers of the tabernacle. Then journeyed the banner of the camp of Reuben, according to their legions. Over its legion was Elizur, son of Shedur. Over the legion of the tribe of the children of Simeon was Shemuel, son of Zurishaddai. Over the legion of the tribe of the children of Gad was Adasoph, son of Duel. Then journeyed the Kohathites, bearers of the sanctuary, and they would erect the tabernacle before the Kohathites arrived. Then journeyed the banner of the camp of the children of Ephraim, according to their legions. Over its legion was Elishama, son of Amihud. Over the legion of the tribe of the children of Manasseh was Gamaliel, son of Pedazur. And over the legion of the tribe of the Benjamin was Abadan, son of Gedoni. Then joined the banner of the camp of the children of Dan, in the rear guard of all the camps. According to legions, over its legion was Ahizir, son of Amishadai. Over the legion of the tribe of the children of Ashur was Pagil, son of Ochran. Over the legion of the tribe of the children of Naphtali was Ahir, son of Enan. These were the journeys of the children of Israel according to their legions, and they journeyed. Moses said to Hobab, son of Reuel, the Midianite father-in-law of Moses, "We are journeying to the place which the Lord has said, I shall give it to you. Go with us, and we shall treat you well. The Lord has spoken good for Israel." He said to him, "I shall not go. Only to my land and my people shall I go." But he said, "Please do not forsake us, as much as you know your encampments in the wilderness, and you have been eyes for us. It shall be that if you come with us, then with the goodness of which the Lord will benefit us, we will do good to you." They journeyed from the mountain of the Lord 3 days' distance, and the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord journeyed before them a 3 days' distance to search out for them a resting place. The cloud of the Lord was over them by day when they journeyed to the camp. When the ark would journey, Moses said, "Arise, Lord, and let your foes be scattered. Let those who hate you flee from before you." And when it rested, he would say, "Reside tranquilly, O Lord, among the myriad thousands of Israel." Chapter 11. When the people took to seeking complaints, it was evil in the eyes of the ears of the Lord. And the Lord heard, and his wrath flared, and a fire of the Lord burned against them. It consumed at the edge of the camp. The people cried out to the Lord, and Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died down. Sorry, let's say it again. People cried out to Moses, and Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died down. He named that place Taberah, for the fire of the Lord had burned against them. The rabble that was among them cultivated a craving, and the children of Israel also wept once more and said, "Who will feed us meat? Remember the fish we ate in Egypt, free of charge, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. But now our life is parched. There is nothing we have, nothing to anticipate but the manna." Now the manna was like coriander seed. Its color was like the color of bedullah. The people would stroll and gather it and grind it in a mill or pound it in mortar and cook with it or in a pot or make it into cakes. Its taste was the taste of dough kneaded with oil. When the dew descended upon the camp at night, the manna would descend upon it. Moses heard the people weeping and their family groups, each one at the entrance of his tent. The wrath of the Lord flared greatly. In the eyes of Moses, it was bad. Moses said to the Lord, "Why have you done evil to your servant? Why have I not found favor in your eyes that you place the burden of this entire people upon me? Did I conceive this entire people, or did I give birth to it, that you say to me, 'Carry them in your bosom, as a nurse carries a suckling, to the land which you swore to its forefathers?' Where shall I get meat to give this entire people when they weep to me, saying, 'Give us meat that we may eat'? I alone cannot carry this entire nation, for it is too heavy for me. And if this is how you deal with me, then kill me now. If I have found favor in your eyes, let me not see my evil." Lord said to Moses, gather to me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom you know to be elders of the people, and its officers. Take them into meeting, and have them stand there with you. I will descend and speak with you there. I will increase some of the spirit that is upon you, and place it upon them. And they shall bear the burden of the people with you, and should not bear it alone. To the people you shall say, prepare yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat. For you have wept in the ears of the Lord, saying, who will feed us meat, or is better for us in Egypt? So the Lord will give you meat, and you will eat. Not for one day you shall eat, nor 2 days, nor 5 days, nor 10 days, nor 20 days, until an entire month of days, until it comes out of your nose, and becomes nauseating to you, because you have rejected the Lord who was in your midst, and you have wept before the Lord, saying, why did we leave Egypt? Moses said, 600,000 foot soldiers are the people whose midst I am, yet you say, I shall give them meat, and they shall eat for a month of days. Can sheep and cattle be slaughtered for them and suffice for them? Or all the fish of the sea we gathered for them, would it suffice for them? Well, said Moses, is the hand of the Lord limited? Now you will see whether my word comes to pass or not. Moses left and spoke the words of the Lord to people. And he gathered 70 men from among the elders of the people and had them stand around the tent. The Lord descended in a cloud and spoke to him. And he increased some of the spirit that was upon him and gave it to the 70 men, the elders. When the spirit rested upon them, they prophesied, but did not do so again. Two men remained behind in the camp. The name of one was Eldad, and the name of the second was Medad. And the spirit rested upon them. They had been among the recorded ones, but they had not gone out the tent, and they prophesied in the camp. The youth ran to told Moses. He said, Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp. Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of Moses, since his youth, spoke up and said, my lord, Moses, incarcerate them. Moses said to him, are you being zealous for my sake? I would that the entire people of the Lord would be prophets. The Lord would place his spirit upon them. Moses was brought into the camp, and he said, he and the elders of Israel, a wind went forth from the Lord and blew quail from the sea and spread them over the camp, a day's journey this way and a day's journey that way, all around the camp and 2 cubits above the face of the earth. The Lord rose up all that day and all that night and all the next day and gathered up the quail. For the one with the least gathered 10 omers, and they spread them out around the camp. The meat was still between their teeth, not yet chewed, when the wrath of the Lord flared against the people. The children struck a very mighty blow against the people. He named that place Kibroth Hattaavah, because there they buried the people who had been craving. From Kibroth Hattaavah, the people journeyed to Hazeroth, and they remained in Hazeroth. 12. Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses regarding the Cushite woman he had married, for he had married a Cushite woman. They said, was it only to Moses the Lord spoke? Did he not speak to us as well? And the Lord heard. Now the man Moses was exceedingly humble, more than any other person on the face of the earth. The Lord said to Moses, said something to Moses and to Aaron and to Miriam, you three, go out of the tent of meeting. The three of them went out. Lord descended in a pillar of cloud and stood at the entrance of the tent. He summoned Aaron and Miriam. The two of them went out. He said, hear now my words. If there shall be a prophet among you, in a vision shall I, the Lord, make myself known to him. In a dream shall I speak with him. Not so is my servant Moses. In my entire house is he the trusted one. Mouth to mouth do I speak to him, in a clear vision and not in riddles. At the image of the Lord does he gaze. Why did you not fear to speak against my servant Moses? The wrath of the Lord flared up against them, and he left. The cloud had departed from atop the tent, and behold, Miriam was afflicted with tzaraat, like snow. Aaron turned to Miriam, and behold, she was afflicted with tzaraat. Aaron said to Moses, I beg you, my lord, do not cast a sin upon us. We have been foolish, and we have sinned. Let her not be like a corpse, like one who leaves his mother's womb with half his flesh having been consumed. Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, "Please, God, heal her now." The Lord said to Moses, "Were her father to spit on her face, would she not have been humiliated for 7 days? Let her be quarantined outside the camp for 7 days, then she may be brought in." So Miriam was quarantined outside the camp for 7 days. People did not journey until Miriam was brought in. People journeyed then from Hazeroth, and they encamped in the wilderness of Paran. A lot of reading. That was Numbers chapter 8 through the first, well, actually, chapter 12, verse 16. Any questions, comments, opinions? Yes, Jared.
If they were complaining about meat, then why didn't they say, "We remember all the meat we had back at Egypt," instead of, "We remember all the fish, cucumbers, leeks, garlic, onions"?
Why the focus on one particular item? They said the meat, of course, that they were after, so they were hungry. And all the other things which they weren't meat, obviously, the vegetable items which they were after. Note, their major complaint wasn't necessarily with just meat, obviously, because they complained about other things too. What were they truly complaining about? It was Moses. They didn't like Moses, they didn't like God. Note what they were complaining about. It was better for us in Egypt. But one of the reasons they had, being stuck in the wilderness, was not their cup of tea. They preferred Egypt over this. That's what God got mad at. It's a process of rejection, which we'll discuss that when we get to that point. Yes. Yes, Deanne.
Can you write that a little darker, blue?
Sorry. I'll choose
I
a different...
I can't read that.
It's just the name of the reading section. Oops. Apparently I can't. That just erased it. I'll get a different one. Hold on. I'll change a different color. That works. Betecha. And this is Bicha. Alotecha. It just means that when you kindle, when you prepare. It's referring. It's the first phrase when Aaron was being assigned to light the candles. That's what it says, the light of the candle, when you kindle the candles, that's what the phrase means, when you kindle the candles, when you set them up. Yes?
Are there two instances where, first was, I thought, Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, told him, you know, gather some men together and they will help you with judgments between the people. And then this passage somewhere, God says, set aside 70 men.
Yep, same type of idea.
Okay, so who did what first? God did it first? Or
who did what first? In the sequence of events, this bluntly, we know enough. Jethro spoke it first, but God was confirming it. Jethro spoke it in Exodus chapter 18, because when Jethro points it out, say, "Moses, you're sitting there in front of all these people, you're judging nonstop all day long. This is all you do. Distribute out the workload." And then God agreed with Jethro and said, "Yes, distribute the workload out and choose someone to judge." Now at that time, the specification was for judging between disputes. So-and-so did such this person, he owes this money, he pays you back, he broke my toy, things like that. You're breaking with your disputes and how you handle these issues. And Moses trying to deal with these issues all alone. Well, in this instance, in this description here, Moses isn't dealing with just their issues of, as far as, you know, disputes between each other, but actually having to hear their complaints about God and complaints about Moses. It's really hard to be the one in charge of hearing all the complaints. It's very frustrating, because all you get are the complaints. People don't say, "Oh, what a great job, great job." People don't do that to leaders. Look at our president. How many complaints does he get versus how many praises does he get? Like 1,000 to 1. There are far more people who complain because complainers are vocal. People who are not complainers typically aren't vocal. They're just content. There's a difference. And it's hard for Moses to handle that. Yes.
Well, I think I want to side with the complainers for a brief minute. I mean, you have 1 million+ people wandering in a desert land. They are staying in one place maybe for 1 or 2 days or a week. They never know how long they're going to stay, so they don't plant gardens. They're foraging for food, and, you know, how far do you have to go to get away from 1.5 million to find something? So how long would you or I last eating one thing only for 40 years?
It would be hard. in the nature of what's happening in the storyline, they do have a little bit more to eat than just manna, but they're limited because they do have their flocks, they have their herds, so there's dairy products which they can make and consume because they don't take much to make. You can make milk go sour really fast. They can make bread and other bread products too. There are also, if that many people, there are also lots and lots of money there that traders are going to sit there and say, we'll just make our caravan swing that area, buy and sell, and then continue on our trip to Egypt. So with that many people, that's going to have a lot of other things happening too. However, what's one thing they're not going to get? Vegetables. And if they kill all their animals, they had no meat, and they wiped out all their dairy products too. Those animals, of course, are going to require grass to eat to keep them alive, because there's a lot of animals there, and you're in a desert type of environment. So herders and shepherds are taking their flocks probably many days' travel outside the camp in order to get them enough food. So not everybody's there hanging around the camp all the time. And on top of that, fire requires wood. Wilderness. How much wood is there? Not a lot. So there's not a lot to work with. But there's also a point, and the biggest issue, which that's my personal thing about it, is just because of history. When you have a large group of people in a relatively confined space, diseases spread like crazy, mostly from human waste. Now, God said you'll go out to the camp when you relieve yourself. But if you have that many people relieve themselves out to the camp two or three times a day, don't go out to the camp anymore. It's going to smell pretty bad out there. But yeah, and the water that's coming through, there's a lot of logistic issues where it's not easy. But that's not what God was complaining, what they were complaining about. They actually cited it was better off in Egypt. That's what got God's anger. It's like, wait a minute, I killed a lot of people to get you guys out of there. I spent a lot of effort to get you free, and now you're complaining that what I am providing for you isn't good enough? They have some history. Well, this is about a year, at least 1 year later. They've been out of Egypt for a little over a year, because they start their first travel experience after they leave Egypt. They go to Mount Sinai. They stay there for almost a full year, just a few days shy of a full year at Mount Sinai. So they're hanging out in this mountain the whole time, and there's pools of water coming out because the splitting rock and things like that. There's no water there, so they have plenty of water to drink. They're hanging out for about a year, and then they get up in camp. And now, if you notice that this journeying process. The very first part of chapter, I think it's chapter 10 or 11. I think it's chapter 11. Or the tail end of chapter 10. Discussing that they leave the wilderness of Sinai, they leave the mountain, they're heading toward the wilderness of Paran, 3 days' journey. And then the remaining parts of chapter 10, 11, and 12 is the process they went through for those 3 days. The complaints they went through for 3 days. So they didn't make it very long if they started to complain after they first had to move. Just a guess. Because it says if God goes for the day and then goes back to evening, they had to build and tear down their tents every single day for 3 straight days. Now, as opposed to what? Walking for 3 days? That's no fun either. So you have to set something up. But they started complaining their first step out, their first try, the first turn, let's proceed to complain. And they complained about lack of food, meat in particular, but also other vegetables and such too, which God does not supply the vegetables. He supplies, of course, with the meat, and a lot of it, which we'll get to there in a minute. It's not easy. It's not easy. And they're going to eat manna for 40 years. It's going to be hard. They're going to be tiring. They're going to be sick of it. But this is what you're going to go through. And when your trials and God brings you out of your difficulties, is it easy? No, it's not. It's not supposed to be easy. You're supposed to point out that, man, it was a lot funner back then. It was a lot easier before. This is harder. I don't want to do this. Is this book the only thing I have to deal with? Come on, where's the fun in that? So there's a lot of things we always walk through, and it's kind of a journeying process. Any comments, questions, opinions, beliefs? Yes.
Two parts. First was about the prophets. You're probably going to say something. The two prophets that prophesied. That prophesied. I mean, we don't know what they prophesied. We just, anyway. Angie made me lose my train of thought here. I guess it wasn't that important.
That's all right. So not just those two men, it says all 70 men prophesy, which means they started to speak words that God was putting inside them. What they all said, no one knows. But they never did it again. So this is a one-time event. And the point is that of the 70 men that Moses called, only 68 showed up. Two of them stayed in the camp, but their names are already cited. So God respected the fact that Moses already selected these men by name. I don't know whether he submitted a list or just wrote it down. I don't know. Somehow God knew what the list was. He's pretty smart that way. And so he got the list and he assigned his spirit upon all of them. Why did those two men not show up? It could be any reason. They could have been ill. They could have been contaminated by somebody. They could have been dealing with their children or their wives or whatever's going on in their lives. It doesn't say why they didn't come with the remaining 68 people, but they were still included in the camp, included in the count of which God was distributing Moses' spirit. And the whole point is to burden or help share the burden of the load, not just through determining what's, you know, this quarreling and disputes between two people, but also to address their complaints. If they have something to complain about, they complain to these men. These men can handle their various complaints. What they cannot handle then is they have to go to Moses. Okay, Moses, we're having various issues. Here's our issues. It's far easier to do this representation type of system than for each individual person to go to Moses and say, here's my problem with you, Moses. That's very tedious and too much for anyone to handle. And Moses said, as he walked the camp, the people at their tents complaining and griping about the lack of the meat. And they're all weeping and crying about it. Well, he's having to hear all this. That's hard as the one man in charge, so to speak. So it's hard to hear anybody complain. Moses complained himself, which we're going to talk about his complaint, which is a very interesting complaint. Yes. Any other comments or questions so far? Before we get to Moses' complaint, there are a few other things to get to first, because he complains toward the tail half. It's the nature of complaint and how you handle it. We'll discuss that in a minute. First of all, this section obviously starts out with the lighting of the menorah. I'm not going to talk about menorahs this time today. I've talked about it previous times in parashah sections past as well as years past. And so the lighting of the menorah, of course, points out that it's going to face things. Now, note the beginning of this in chapter 8, it starts out, this is just after all the various offerings the various tribes came up. So lots of different offerings came up and God was offering these various things for the altar, dedication of the altar. Excuse me. Now what, if you remember, what is the purpose and function of the animal sacrifice altar? What does it do? Not sin covering, that's individual offerings. Right, it's the location. It's the place which you offer these things. The altar itself is a place. What you offer is correct. It has to deal with its sin offerings, has to deal with your various free will offerings, your peace offerings, isn't that what you're offering? The process which Jeff covered last time was the actual altar itself. That's the tail end of this. So once they dedicated it, all the tribes that equally gave their animals what they were offering, the altar of the animals, this is the animal one in particular, not to be confused with the incense altar. This is the animal altar one. After they were offered, that's when then Aaron comes on the scene and says, and God says, light the menorah. Or the candlestick. Why would God put this, light the menorah, after the altar? Simple. What's the symbolism behind them? The altar has its functions. Its primary function is to receive your offerings, whatever they are, to God. What's the menorah's primary function? For God to look at you. So, when after they've offered... Oh, I'm sorry. I'll repeat it a few times. So the altar's function, the animal one in particular, is receive your offerings. Your offerings include, obviously, bulls, sheep, goats. You can do birds, certain birds. And yes, it also has the grain offering is burned for each of these. And there's during certain offerings, there's a wine libations poured out on the altar, on the offerings as well. So there's also grain and wine. That's what is used on this particular animal altering. Now, we look at this and we don't do any of this stuff, which is not true as Christians. Every one of us do this, we just don't know it. So this is commonly done. This is God's altar. Once the altar is dedicated, which means God is now going to accept all your offerings, then God says, okay, Open my eyes, Aaron, and I will now watch what the people do. And what is the menorah supposed to be facing? So it's face frontward. What does it look at the whole time? There's a thing that's looking at. There's a particular object that's looking at. Do you remember what the object is? Showbread. It's a table, showbread. So a table that the menorah is always facing, looking at, of bread. And it's 12 loaves. Represents the 12 tribes. So... So when yes, when all 12 tribes offer their altar offerings to sanctify the altar, then chapter Numbers 8, open my eyes, Aaron, and now I will look at the 12 loaves, the 12 tribes continuously. I will now watch them and see what they do with their lives and how they conduct themselves. This is how we kind of introduce from the animal offerings over into now what's God's response to it. Does that kind of make sense? Yes, Deanne.
Well, how does him smelling everything work in? And because he likes the aroma. And how does
yes,
that
he does
work
mention
into
a few
it?
A few details here. One in particular, when he's dealing with the atonement offering for the Levites, there's two offerings there, which we'll get to shortly. Have to do with one is a whole or all burnt up offering, and the other one is a sin offering. They do two different things. As far as a scent, that's a hair beyond my scope today, but I can cover it in like 2 minutes, all right? And I won't give anyone dedication to it. Each of these animals have, who cares what the animal is, depends on who you are, but what the offering is, whether it's a sin, whether it's a free will or burnt offering, you are in, says burnt, it could be a sin offering or a feast offering. And the feast offerings, peace offering, yes, feast or peace, they're used sometimes interchangeably. Feast or peace offering. All of these have their functionality and their purpose. Depending on how you offer them dictates whether God's going to receive your offering or not. If you're a sin-filled person and have no intention of repenting or doing anything different but your sins, is he going to receive your sin offering? Of course not. So is the aroma pleasing? No, it's not. Stinks. So that's the point of, if it's a pleasing aroma, he's receiving it from you. If it's not pleasing, he hates it. It's disgusting. So don't do it. Why? It's not, it has nothing to do with necessarily the food because he doesn't eat. It has to do with what we as people, when we bring our offering is, where is our heart, our mind, our soul, and strength? Where are they? What are those four things in that state of mind when you bring your offering up? That has to do with the animal offering and the grain offering and everything that details with it. Once we've done those things and we are in the right frame of spirit when we're offering these things, they become pleasing aromas to God. Once this altar has been dedicated from chapter 7 of Numbers, now God opens his eyes and he's watching us. What are we going to do from here on out? Now, that makes sense? That's why the menorah is placed shortly after the altar offering dedication ceremony process. Incense, that's incense offerings. Don't confuse those with the animal offerings. The altar in particular is animal. The incense offering, which is, again, beyond the scope of new today, incense, its altar has, it's a gold altar. Golden altar. This is over here is bronze. The gold altar, that is strictly prayers. P-R-A-Y-E-R-S. Close enough. That's prayer offering. That's different than your actual animal offerings. They are not the same thing. So the incense altar has certain spices go with it, certain whatever the aroma that he says you will do this formula only. That's to do with your prayers. That's different than what your animal offerings happen to be. That makes sense? So the altar here was the animal offering they were doing earlier. And that menorah, of course, focuses upon the 12 loaves, which means upon you, me, him, everybody else. God's watching us now. Make sense? Okay, let's move on from this introduction to go into what God's going to do, or chooses to do. Okay, so after he does this altar process, I'm going to erase this because I don't need it anymore. He says, all right, I'll take the Levites. We discussed this previously. What's the functionality of taking the Levites? Why would God take them?
So it won't be so confusing.
Yeah, it's easy. It's far more difficult for him to say, okay, every firstborn, male and beast, you're all mine. Okay, which was that one born first? I don't know. Check, which came out first? Was it Zerah and Perez? Zerah put his hand out first. He was born first. They tied a little marker, but he brought it back in. When Perez comes out, okay, who's firstborn? Zerah? Sure. Maybe you could argue it. Who goes first? Who knows? You have to decide who's rightfully the firstborn, who has to go serve God, who doesn't. Life gets complicated that way. So we don't do it that way. God said, I've already done the substitution process, because I already took the firstborn of Egypt. Oops. That firstborn, the death process. When he did that, he said, I sanctified all firstborn come to mind. So he took the firstborn of Egypt and then substituted them as firstborn of Israel. He sanctified them. Then he then swaps the firstborn of Israel out for Levi. Later on, we'll find out he swaps Levi out for Messiah. But the whole point is it's a process which God's doing an exchange system. So he took the first one in Egypt, he sanctified these people. He swapped these people out for Levi over here. He swaps Levi out for Messiah later on. That's many years later. But it's all a process. So to do this, how are we going to do this? How do we swap these people out? Well, you got to clean them up first. You wouldn't give a firstborn out of its mother. The priest said, here you go. He said, well, at least towel it off first. I mean, come on, wipe it down or something. This is messy. You wash it up. Get yourself clean. When you go before God, do you show up in an ugly mess? Or do you try to clean your life up? Clean yourselves up. Who doesn't try to clean themselves up? If you go to a fancy restaurant, do you show up in your painting clothes of you were just gardening and you look a disgusting mess? No. You try to dress halfway decent, depending which one you go to, who knows. And what that looks like, that's debatable. But the point is, you try to clean yourself up when you're going to present yourself. Well, Levi's the same way. The firstborn's the same way. Everyone's the same way. You present yourself for God, make yourself look halfway decent. How does God accept this? They say you have to have fancy shoes? No. Does he say you have to have a certain garments on? Well, sort of, but not yet. What does he say? Wash yourself. You'll do it this way. And this is the way he's going to do it. The first process, you will obviously wash them, sprinkle them with water of purification, as it says in verse 7 of chapter 8. So shall you do them, purify them, sprinkle water on them of purification. And what is the water of purification? Do you remember what that is? The red heifer water. So it's live water. Let them pass a razor over their entire flesh and immerse themselves in garments. That's not very comfortable. There's two different traditions on what a razor means. One means shave yourself to where there is no hair left. And the other version is cut your hair really, really short to where you're close enough to razor it off. It's not really considered a razor, but it's very, very short. Both are considered acceptable. No one knows which one they're actually doing here. It's too hard to tell. Either way, one of them is considered done. So they cut off all the excess of hair. Why? What's wrong with hair? It does collect sweat and dirt. There's also a symbolic reason to it. Anybody remember what the symbolic reason was about hair? What's the Nazirite vow? Remember the Nazirite vow rules? It is a covering. What does it cover? It covers your head. It has a symbolic reason for it, though, beyond just the head covering. There's actually one more step to that. God is a covering. It's a type of offering of your body, in a manner of speaking. In the Nazirite vow, which essentially the tribe of Levi is following a Nazirite vow cycle. But instead of the Nazirite vow, which ends at a certain date and time, this is their entire existence. So Nazirite vow. Yes. They're getting pieces, not the entire symbol, but parts of it. In a Nazirite vow, you don't drink any wine. So wine's out. No grape or any wine products. No grape products. And hair. Now, the hair rule is that when you start your vow, cut all your hair off. And you let your hair grow untouched. But you can wash it. Don't cut it again until your vow's time cycle ends. Then you cut that hair off and you burn it as an offering to God. All right? That's obvious. You dedicate what you did. And then after which you would then go out your life. If for some reason you make a mistake, maybe you're going, let's say your Nazirite vow lasts for a year. You cut yourself off, 6 months go by, and you actually took and ate a grape. Oops! Sorry. You don't start your whole year over again, but cut the hair off you have and restart the growing process. Not for the full year, because your time set has already been set. It's been set for a certain given time period. But your offering up from the point which you began up to the point which you took grapes just got thrown out. I mean, that section is discarded. You lost 6 months. Hopefully, you don't make mistakes one day before your Nazirite vow ends. It's like, whoops. Because then the whole year is wasted, or however long your Nazirite vow happens to be. You could do vows for up to a few months, up to a few years, up to just shy of a full lifetime. I say just shy because you're not allowed to be born that way. You have to be the following, the 8 days over later. So you just shy of a whole lifetime. So all those vows are legitimate. The hair process is symbolic of your time you are dedicating to God for whatever length you have set, whether it be months or years. That's the symbolic process. It's record of, it's recording and a reminder. It's much like the tzitzit we wear. It's a reminder not to forget. God said, Daniel, I'm watching you. So that's the whole point. So remember, this hair is reminding you, oh yeah, don't cut my hair. Remember, God's watching me. I'm supposed to be serving him. It's a reminder to us. So once this hair is cut off, I have completed my service. It is finished. I go on about my life, whatever it may be. And the vow is done. In the Levi process, they use the same hair symbolic ideas that you cut it all off, you wash yourself, but the Levi doesn't have an ending listed. Will it end? Of course. A man when he's 50 years old, but the Levi, the tribe, their service lasts their whole lives. It's a never-ending thing from generation to generation. It's always going on. So their process of beginning is always there. So unlike the Nazirite vow, which has a defined time cycle, months, weeks, years, whatever it is, Levi has generations. It's generations later before it ends. When does it end? We'll discuss that some other time. We discussed it previously at various issues, intervals, but we're not discussing it today. Okay, so in the process of doing this, this Nazirite vow type of style or the hair cutting is going to be involved in it. But what's the other unique thing that's involved in it?
In what?
In the Levites. When they said you'll wash yourselves and take the sin of bull offering, all that good stuff, right? What do the people, children of Israel do? Lay their hands on them. So Levi, unlike a Nazirite vow, Levi gets their hands laid on. I don't know how many there were. There are lots of people laying their hands on. Who cares? The point is, you get your hands laid on. So hands. Oops, NDS. Laid on. So when you're laying your hands on, what does that symbolically mean? What are you doing? Yeah, it's one of two things. You can either bless somebody, laying a hand, or you're casting, putting your sins on them. Those are two things which you would usually do with your laying on hands. When you bless somebody, for example, if you recall when Jacob blessed Ephraim Manasseh, he crosses his hands over, he put his hands on their heads. Laying on hands could do two things. One, blessing, or one, other one, transferring whatever you have to them. Now, it might be a sin, as in the laying of hands on goats. You lay hands on the goats for atonement. There's a process of you transferring your sin, your responsibility for the sins you've done onto the goat. Or in the case of Levi, when Levi lays their hands on the bull. So they put their hands on a bull after that Israel puts hands on them. And they transfer all their sins on the bull, right? It's transfer. What's the same as this? See, Egypt firstborn got transferred to Israel firstborn, got transferred to Levi firstborn. Levi's firstborn sins, Egypt's sins got transferred to Israel's firstborn sins, Levi's firstborn sins got transferred to the bull. It's a whole process. We clean them all up. So, every transfers. It's a transfer.
Is that giving them authority to speak?
It is. And in this instance, when the firstborn of Israel, which includes the whole all of Israel, lay their hands on Levi, you are giving your responsibility, which is to serve God. Your responsibility is now being transferred. You are physically representing a transfer over to somebody else. You do it in place of me. It's your responsibility to take care of. And Levi says, okay, I'll do it. Well, not much of a choice matter, but they're going to do it. This whole process of transfer. So in the case of laying on the Levi, when Israel laid on Levi, they're transferring their authority over. But now Levi says, okay, I have the authority. God says, now we're going to clean you up. Clean you because you have to serve in my holy sanctuary. You have a responsibility to keep yourself clean. Why we do this? Yeah. If you are a sinner and your job is to stand and serve in front of somebody else for their sins. We've done this diagram before. I like the diagram. That's why I do it. So pretend God's hanging out there. He looks like the sun because he's hot and bright. He really doesn't. I'm just doing it simple. And you have a guy over here saying, hey, I screwed up. And God says, yeah, you screwed up. You did whatever it was, and that's actually a death penalty. God says, please forgive my sins. Levi comes and says, hey, I'll stand in front of him. I'll present him. It's okay. And God says, are you kidding me? You have more sins than he does. I'll whack you off first. Okay, next. It doesn't do any good. If the sinner is standing in front of, hey, kill me instead, God says, you've got your own problems I have to kill you for. You need somebody to stand in front of you, not in front of him. It won't do you any good. It's not going to do him any good. You're not serving him. Hence, we have the story of Eli and his sons. What happened to Eli and his sons? What did they do? Their job was to stand in front of the people of Israel before God and present the people's offering to God. And God said, are you kidding me? Look at you. Look what you're doing. You're making their sins worse because of your own sins. So God took out Eli and his sons. And now who do the people have? Well, they wouldn't have anybody. So what did God do? He did a quick, you know, excuse me, we'll change curtains real quick. And God says, I'm going to move over to the land of Philistines for 6 months, out of your presence. Then I'll come back. Get yourself straightened up, understand what you did, some of the problems you've occurred, and then we'll come back and we'll fix this and start again. So,
did they take the cart?
Yeah, that was the cart. The Philistines captured the ark at the time, and then the two calves, I can't remember.
Oxen
would travel the cart back and brought it back to Israel. That was about 6 months later. So God temporarily excused himself from the scene for that period of time. So the point is, when you want somebody to stand in front of you, what do you want? They had better be better off than you are. Hence, we get the idea of Messiah standing before the throne of God and presenting us. He has to be better off than we are. Otherwise, it's worthless. He might as well just step aside. Because it doesn't do any good. Anyway, he said, won't help you. So you need someone who is cleaner than you to stand in front of you and say, hey, I got this covered, God. I'll protect, hide them up, and we'll deal with the issues and take care of them. So you always want someone cleaner. Hence, Levi, now you're going to serve on behalf of all of Israel. Clean yourself up. Sin offering, the bull. Now you can serve. Does it make sense? Let's move on. Let's see here. Okay. Ah. Chapter, let's go to the next section, next chapter. It's chapter, where is it? 9. Pesach offering. I like this topic.
What offering?
Pesach, Passover. Passover, Pesach, Passover. Same thing, two different words. Mean same thing. So Pesach. Also, it's Passover. How many holy days do you get two chances at?
One.
Which one is it?
Passover.
This one. You only get two tries. Two tries. Means if you miss it the first month, the 14th of the first month, you have the 14th of the second month, you can do it. Can you do it for any other holy day?
No.
Can you do it for any other Shabbat? No. Can you do it for any other day of that God ever designated? No. Why this one? Because it's really, really important. It's really important. Yeah. What is the functionality of symbolism behind Passover? What does it do for you and me? It protects us from death in a particular way. So it's provided for protection. P-R-O-tech. Protection is from death. What kind of death are we referring to?
Well, the firstborn are all dying.
The firstborn are all dying. It's death from God. It's eternal death. Well, In this idea of protection from death, the people had to just obviously obey. They put the lamb on the blood on their posts and such for around the doorposts. But this Passover, it kicks off the beginning of the entire holiday cycle. All the Shabbats, which are actually weekly, it doesn't start with Passover. The Shabbats are weekly, so it's the only one. It's a more of a festival as opposed to a holiday cycle. But all the other holidays are based off the beginning of Passover. Passover starts them. You have Days of the Living follows. You have Shavuot that follows that. Well, you're counting the first fruits. Then Shavuot follows that. Then you have trumpets. You have the atonement. You have Sukkot. You have Shemini Atzeret. You have all the various holidays are all cycled through this based on Passover. Passover represents something in particular to us as Messiah died for us on Passover, for his symbolism. What did it gain us when he died? What was his objective? It was life. He wanted to get us life. Now, what kind of life was he after? Was it after us have a good time? No. Go enjoy ourselves? No, it's called eternal life is what he's after. Eternal life. Now, eternal life is something that God in particular has is a gift or an assignment. He can give it out. Do you earn eternal life? No, you are granted eternal life. You don't earn it, you granted it. It's a gift to you. What you do and how you conduct your life is different, but eternal life is a gift. So if we miss Passover, we miss the gift, symbolically of course, of eternal life that God's handing out. Yes.
We do have to earn it. We have to learn the Torah. And we have to do
That's how you live, not how you get it. There's a difference. So what is eternal life? You're getting what is eternal life. That's the actual living it. It's life. What is life? Well, life has all of God's instructions. You will conduct yourself in this manner. You will treat people this way. You will worship me in this manner. This is which it is acceptable to be and how you will serve others. That's how you live eternal life, not how you get it. You get it as a gift from God. There's a difference. So Passover is how you get it. How you live it is all the instructions, how you live it. There's a difference. So if we don't get it, we don't receive it, did we ever get a chance to live it? No, because you don't get it to begin with. So what's the important part of Passover? Get the eternal life. So if you missed it, what's important? Oh, try again. Don't miss it. This is an important one. All the other holy days point to how you conduct your life. How is your relationship between you and God? How do you handle these circumstances with one another? So that's how you live it. That's different. Living it is different than actually receiving it. You can't earn it. You have to receive it as a gift. You live it as the instructions once God instructs you. The people who are observing the first Passover, did they know anything about God's laws? Teeny, teeny specks. They knew he existed. They knew there was a promise involved. And they knew that he probably loved them, maybe. That's what the extent of it. If we don't know more, how do we find out more about it? After Passover, when they received the instructions from Moses. Moses, after Passover, then Moses, okay. Actually, Moses doesn't say it, God does. Moses receives them, all the instructions. Yes, all the ones came out of Egypt, in particular. So the original Passover went through this process. They got redeemed or saved first. Take care of that first. You didn't earn it. You just give it to you. Even says Moses, tells people at Moses' time, they're about to enter the Red Sea, tells people to shut up and be quiet. Step aside. I'll take care of this. Do nothing. And watch. He said, watch your salvation. So to receive it, you have to be taken or accepted or redeemed by God. So that's how you get it. Then after they got it, they went to Moses, or the mountain, 3 months later, roughly, 2.5 months later. And that's they receive the instructions. Here's the Ten Commandments. M-A-N-D-S. They have all the various instructions too, the tabernacle, the menorah, the offerings, everything else is all done. That's how you live your life. That's independent of actually receiving it. So receiving it's the important part. God said, if you miss the receiving, try again. I don't want to miss you. I want you to be part of this. So, second month, do it again. Then afterward, if for some reason you chose not to receive it, that's a different problem. If you're choosing not to receive it, I am clean, I don't want to go anyway, I like my life the way it is. Well, that is a conscious decision of you saying, God, I really don't want your gift. I wish to continue on my own way. That's a decision you make. I won't discuss that today. It's not. It's just something that just is. People do things that are foolish. Okay, let's continue on. Two Passovers. Now, obviously, we had the example here. The gentleman came, a few men came, and they were contained by their corpse. Of course, you cannot offer God's Passover when you can by corpses. So he said, okay, we have to wait the next month to have this happen. And God instructs that there are certain details. If you've chosen to not follow, that you will be cut off, which of course means you will be dead. Doesn't say how you'll be dead, just be dead. He may kill you, somebody else may kill you. If you choose to reject the Passover, you didn't just reject Passover, you rejected everything. Because Passover is the kickoff point. It's the first step. It's the gift that God gives to you. That's step one. If you reject the step one, there are no more steps. You just reject the Messiah, it's gone. There's nothing else for you then. If you throw them out, you throw them out, you throw them out. Any questions so far about that part? So we know how important Passover is, and why we want to do it. If we miss it, sick, illness, whatever, do it again. Now that's referring to Passover, then again, not all of the holidays. You don't shift all the holidays a month later. They're set by the original one. It's just the event of that evening, the Passover meal with the unleavened bread and the bread that, and the herbs. That's that part is done again. But everything else is retains the main schedule with no changes, because it's not the entire community, it's just you. Okay. Interesting part. I'm going to erase this because I don't need it anymore. This part I find interesting, my personal opinion. So I have, in the tail end of chapter 9, let's see, we go. Okay. The tabernacle, getting set up and taken down. Now, I won't discuss all the different beliefs and what the tabernacle looked like, or how it was constructed, all the details of what it looked like this, or it looked like that, easy to put up, hard to put up, yada, yada, yada. It made a difference. So the tabernacle, when they would get up or they would move, if you noticed in this, the tail end of chapter 9, God repeats himself over and over again, or the author repeats himself over and over. What does he say? Israel would maintain the charge of the Lord and would not journey. There's various times he rattles off. This is chapter 9 of the book of Numbers, from verse 15 all to the end of the chapter. It repeats again and again that they would only journey according to the word of the Lord. So the journeying process. That's not right. How do you spell journey? G-O-U-R? J-O-O. Thank you. At what condition would they journey? Whatever God said. Whatever the God said, or in this case, the cloud. So we're using the God, was also the cloud in particular. Now, what do we already know about this particular cloud? We already know this because... Moses camped right next to the main tabernacle, so they're kind of all hanging out the same spot. But the cloud itself, it goes from cloud to fire and back and forth, meaning it's nighttime or daytime. And the cloud, we already learned from the process of learning about the cloud itself, who is the cloud? God. Messiah in particular, yes. So Messiah is the cloud. So Messiah is the one who says, we're going to go, we're going to stay. We're going to go, we're going to stay. Every time as we go along. And we lead them all over the place. In the countryside, this town, that town, whatever. I have a question for you, which I think is funny. It's just, to my mind, this is a sense of humor that I think is just there, which is my opinion, though. This process of moving, why would he do that?
I know why.
Go ahead.
To make you wait on him.
Make you wait on him. To follow you. It's a nature of learning to follow, to travel or follow. Well, Messiah lived as a flesh and blood human being at some point in his existence. It was for, you know, roughly some argue 30 years, 33 years, whatever. Period of time which he was alive. What did he do? If I'm going to observe and watch the people of Israel journey following this cloud, from this point to that point, from a day, a week, a month, a year, however the cloud moves, it tries to move, they all move with it. I'm going to have to watch and expect to see the same thing with the one who's actually the same man, known as Messiah, when he comes alive and living on the earth. I would expect he's going to act like this cloud acts, because the cloud is supposed to be him. Because note, if it's in my nature to do something, and it is me, will I always do it? Yeah, because it's in my nature to do so, and it's me. So, if the cloud is Messiah, and it's the nature of the cloud to move all the time, well, when Messiah shows up in flesh and blood, is he going to move all the time? Yeah, he's going to move all the time. And what's going to happen when he moves?
Everybody's going to follow
him. Why do you think Messiah kept traveling And it says he went out to the wilderness here, or people here, and people followed him. When this part, they followed him. They kept following him. Whenever he showed, they all show up at his door, block the entrance to the rooms. You couldn't get in, couldn't get out. They were following wherever he went. That's the point. The cloud's goal, it's a symbolic point out, Israel, you're going to follow me wherever I go. And you're going to seek after me wherever I set my foot down, where I sit down, I'm going to stop and talk to you or visit with you. You're all going to hang out and want to come at me. That's why the Messiah was alive. He didn't wander around for the fun of it because he needed exercise. He was saying to the people, you're going to try to follow and seek me wherever I go. It's the nature of following. So I would expect this to happen. I think it's funny, but that's just how I think it. So anytime that this cloud is deciding to move, and it was kind enough to move during the day, not so much at nighttime, Messiah is going to move. Messiah is going to move and have everybody follow the various places he's going to follow. Go ahead and read the first few chapters of all the Gospels. What's he doing? Going from this synagogue, that synagogue, place to place, place, and people are following behind him, talking with him, wishing to get healed by him, whatever the cases might be. Note, what's the cloud's function back in Moses' time? Well, people come to Moses, to come to Aaron, and say, hey, I have this problem, I have this issue, help me with my problems, heal my skin, whatever it may be, heal me, take care of me. That's what happened in Moses' time. So we get the exact same thing should happen in Messiah's time, too. That'll follow him. Here's my issues. Here's my problems. Heal me. Take care of these demons I'm possessed with. These various things, you're going to have to follow to match the same pattern. Why would God choose that pattern? Greatest like sheep. You have to trust something. When you seek something, you pursue it because you want it. You believe that's what you need or want. You desire that. It's actually a type of coveting. It's a different style of coveting. You're not coveting things, objects. You're coveting your salvation, your relationship with God. Is he okay with that kind of coveting?
Yes.
He's okay with that kind of coveting. He wants you to want him. That's the point. But if you always pursue it, that's the nature of coveting. When we covet things that are negative for us, what do? We pursue them, don't we? Yeah, we pursue them. We want them. I want this. I go after it because your heart is drawn toward it. So coveting God, your heart should be drawn toward him. Follow the cloud, because what does the cloud provide for you?
Shelter,
protection, salvation, love, life, everything. Provides everything for you. Food, obviously the manna, the quail, everything else. It provides all these things for you, so you want it. It's the nature of how it's going to work. So this is a positive event. So God's using this process as a nature of your journey. You will, if you want me, you will follow me wherever I lead you. And wherever I go, you will follow me. That's a good thing. So, it is like Ruth. The same principle, it's repeated over and over again in the Bible, various times. So we have this whole idea of wherever God goes, you follow him. So wherever Messiah goes, you follow him. Wherever the cloud goes, you follow him. And what does Moses point out when the ark leaves, which that's the tail end of chapter 10, when the journey says, flee those who hate you, and when you sit down, rest among the myriad thousands of Israel. So the objective of the people in Moses, the statement right there, the tail end of chapter 10, it's verse 35-36, is that when God rests his cloud, Messiah, when you stop moving, I'm sitting right here, X marks the spot, when you stop moving, where should that be? In the myriad thousands of Israel, where Israel is all around you. You're fully surrounded. That's when Moses is declaring, every time the ark moves and settles down, may your enemies be scattered when you move, and wherever you set, may all of Israel surround you. So when Messiah is alive, when he's healing people and providing for them, doing lots of stuff, what's going to happen? People don't just follow him, they're going to surround him. Surround him. Don't go away. We're trapping you inside amongst us, so to speak. That's the goal. That's the idea. Now with this imagery, go back to our instruction of chapter the patterns of people walking and such in the camp. So chapter 10 points out that they, or chapter 11 I think it is, they point out that the camp is surrounded by the tabernacle. You have there are three different tribes on all sides. And you have, obviously, there's, I think it's on this side. I forgot which side it is. You have the three different sections of Levi all around it. that God dwells and he's always surrounded by Israel all the time. This is a positive thing. This is God's objective. When they actually travel, some argue how they travel, mostly argue it's a straight line. They travel where they're going. And wherever the cloud decides to move them, that's where they end up traveling. That's, again, a positive thing. It's all symbolism of surround him, surround your God, surround your creator at all time. Hey, great, thank you for that. To surround him, his goal is the surrounding. He wants to be amongst the midst of everybody all the time. Wherever he goes, whether it be the wilderness or anywhere else, makes no difference. Let's continue on. There's more stuff here. I'm gonna skip one section, which is how the ark is reconstructed, or the temple is reconstructed every time. That's not that critical, but what the details are. The fact that the tabernacle gets built before the ark shows up. So when they're following somewhere, if they're traveling in these, I'm assuming straight lines. So we'll just, you know, all the people, the straight lines, the cloud. Oops, that's an L. The cloud travels where the cloud stops, all the tribes stop, and then that's where the second people in line, which I should say is the tabernacle, it gets rebuilt, and then the tribes start arriving, and then the ark gets put in. So the people in the Merari and Gershon, they've got to build this tabernacle relatively quickly, as far as before the ark shows up. So they have a home for God, so to speak. Let's move on. So, chapter 11. Complainers. I was joking with Jeff when we started that if the people hadn't complained and when God gave the Ten Commandments, the tail end said, oh, it's too scary for us. If they had not complained about that, he'd probably give an 11th commandment saying, don't complain. Don't complain. God really doesn't like complainers. Who likes complainers?
I don't.
I've yet to meet anybody who likes complainers. Because it's awful to hear complaints. Does God like complainers? No. How many times do we complain to God? All the time. How many of your prayers, my prayers, are complaints? God, this didn't work out right. God, what are you doing? God, how come I can't do this? Why isn't this? Why can't you do that, God? Why does that be? How many times do we complain? Yeah, we do it all the time, don't we? But he said he doesn't like complainers. Now, do we deal with our problems that way? Sure, we have to bring our problems to him. But the point is, he doesn't like complainers. What's the difference between complaining and having problems?
Be grateful.
Let's discuss how Moses dealt with complaints and how he complains to God and addresses the problems, how God addresses his problem. Because there is a, some argue, subtle difference. To me, it's a little bit more than subtle, but that's just my opinion. So, complainers. You will notice when you read the Torah, in particular the book of Numbers, you will notice there's a lot of complaints along the way. And God strikes and strikes and strikes the complainers. Yes, Bill?
To me, it seems like it'd be like how your attitude is when you come at it with a complaint.
Those of you who have kids, when your child comes to you and has a problem, they may complain about whatever this issue is, that thing or whatever it is. How does a child respond to you as you're the parent, you're instructing, okay, child, do X, Y, Z to fix your problem? How does a child respond? See, when someone comes to complain for the sake of complaining, they'll find another complaint pretty quick. How many times you complain because you're hell-bent about complaining? And you're just mad, or whatever solution somebody has, I don't care, I'm complaining anyway. I don't care what your solution. There's going to be more complaints. Your solution's not good enough. There's something wrong with it. More complaints. That's complaining because you want to complain. You're enjoying it. You're happy in your complaining space. Go somewhere else. But in God's world of complaints, when you have a complaint and you want him to fix it, don't complain about how he fixes it. This is his fix. Because his fix is always better than your plan is. I may have a particular fix in my head. God, you have to do this, this, and this. He says, are you kidding me? Erase, erase, erase. I'm going over here and doing this and ignoring your complaints for a while because you'll find out what I'm going to deal with it. And I'll sit here and complain and stomp my feet. No, God, do it my way. No, he's over here. I'm doing this. I'm ignoring you. And then all of a sudden, my complaints vanish. Because something he did way over there, all of a sudden fixed and did some strange stuff through a whole strange path, messed up and changed my complaints. I now have a new list. My old list went away. Yes, Bill.
Then you'd have to complain that you don't have anything to complain about.
You have nothing to complain about, but then you're dead. There's nothing to complain about. So the nature of complaint is a problem, or complaining. So the nature of how we complain is an issue. So complaining, complaining for the sake of complaining is not useful to anyone. Oh, yes, Daniel.
So this seems worthy of a word study. You know, comparing complaint with crying out.
Because they are different. They are subtly different. There's details on some of these things.
And reading, you know, David's Psalms construed as complaints.
The complaints that we're talking about specifically right now is how Moses dealt with this complaint. Because note, the people complained to Moses. What did Moses do? Complain to God. But what did God do? He fixed Moses' problem, and he whacked the people. So, wait a minute. I don't understand. Didn't they both complain? Aren't they both the same? They're not the same. There was a difference between how they complained. Yes, Dan.
Well, I complain, but then I'm like, okay, can you just show me what I need to know what to do so I can fit whatever reason this is happening to me, show me what I'm doing wrong so I can fix it. Is that complaining?
That's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about this topic specifically for the next few minutes. Talk about this issue of complaining. Now, the people complain, and Moses complained. What did Moses complain about specifically?
The people. They're driving
him nuts. Get rid of these people. I'd rather be dead. So Moses actually goes on, he addresses it. Moses complains about the complainers. Now, I have a question for you. This is just, it's a comical thing. This is a comical relief. When, how many times when God says, hey, Jim Schmuley, see, I'm improving, go do this, whatever it is, and you being Jim saying, no, I'm going to do that. You being, God tells you, go do something. And you tell him, he's talking to you face to face. We're not talking like in a dream. He says, hey, go do this. You hear the voice, you hear, you see, and you say, no, I'm not going to do that. I won't. You can't make me. I won't do that. I just won't do it. There are not many people who do that. Me personally, I'd be afraid to do that. Why? Because I'm afraid he may say, okay, guess what? If you didn't do it, you don't do it, what's going to happen over here that you won't like? Not say to punish you, but the events which you would like to pan out great for you, I'm going to change them. It'll pan out great for somebody else, and you'll just have to deal with the consequences yourself. I don't want to receive the, not the smiting, but the neglect, the ignoring me. I don't want the ignoring me. No, address my problems too, please, God. Don't ignore me. Like I'm trying to ignore you. So don't treat me the way I'm treating you, essentially. So the nature of complaint. Not many said no. Moses says no. In this way. Different living, though. Jonah says no. Yeah. Who else says no? Peter said no. Who else says no? One... The in the dream, the sheet dream. Son Judah, yes. Well, wait a minute. Which event? The 10 spies. They said no. 10 spies. Let's see here. Well, various people say no. Now, what Adam and Eve said no. Let's see. And Abraham said, let's make a deal. A little difference. Abraham did a deal. But, Adam and Eve said no. Pharaoh said no, yep. How well did it turn out for those who said no? Let's see here. Not so good for Jonah. Not so good for the 10 spies. Not so good for Adam and Eve. Not so good for Pharaoh. Kind of ended poorly for those who said no. He repented, I get that. He repented, and Adam and Eve, they have their redeeming qualities too. They did live their long lives. God said, you will work till you're dead, but you will at least live a long time. You have lots of kids. You'll enjoy your life, and you'll live it, and all the good stuff. And Pharaoh, unfortunately, he didn't end well. But the 10 spies didn't end well either. And the 10 spies who instigated a rebellion as well, the people who followed them, the 40 years in the wilderness. Oops. Yeah, you got the whole group in trouble. So saying no has... not a guaranteed problem, but a frequency problem. It happens regularly. It doesn't do so well. So, but what Peter say no to? He didn't know the sheet thing. He wasn't saying, no, I won't follow you, God. He knows because he didn't understand it yet. There's a difference. Peter didn't understand what God was doing. Once he understood, he followed quite contently. What did Moses say no to? I don't want to deal with these people anymore. Kill me now. I'm not doing this anymore, God. Get rid of me. I'd rather be dead. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm done with this. I'm finished. Abraham, he was more of a make a deal because he said, okay, how do we negotiate Sodom and Gomorrah's non-demise? God then wanted to obviously wipe out Sodom and Gomorrah anyway. But Abraham tried to make a deal. It just didn't quite work out so well. So it's arguable to put him there in this category or not. That's debatable. But the point is, complainers have run a risk. But these men complained too. But they trusted and they ended up differently. Why were Moses and Peter different endings than these other endings were? Now, Jonah, of course, eventually turned around too, but after he had a lot of suffering to go through in the process. So eventually he turned around as well. But these two endings, God didn't smite them. It wasn't a suffering process. It was a future fix. Here's how you address it. How you deal with it. What's different between these two men versus somebody else? Ah, there's something they knew about God. Didn't have to. Didn't have to. We'll discuss this. There's a nature about Moses and Peter and a few others too, not many, that he did something in particular that was unique that everybody else did. When your child complains to you, and they are not receptive to your fix, they just choose to complain more. What does it do to you as a parent? Get you mad. And what do you do? Yeah, buddy, go sit against the wall. Get out of here. I'm done with you. If your child says, I've got a problem, this is my problem, here's your fix, and your child says, oh, thank you, and goes off and does the fix, what does it do to you as a parent? You became useful. Good job. Good job, son. Good job, daughter. Good job, child. You did it right. You see, complaint without receiving correction or improvement is complaining for the sake of complaining. Complaint without willing to receive correction or the solution, you are complaining for the sake of complaining. You just want to complain. You want your way to be done. When you're willing to receive the solution, that's different. You would actually have a problem you need God to address. The difference between complaints and problems. Problems, you're looking for the solution. Complaint, you're looking for camaraderie. Yes.
I think even Messiah came to Yahweh with a problem.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want to die. He said,
your will
nevertheless.
Yeah, whatever the solution is, God, I don't want to deal with this, but your solution is for me to die anyway. So he had his problem, but he accepted the solution. Now, the people, when they had their problems, what was their complaint about? Specifically against God and that Egypt was better. You'd rather go back. That God, it's not that I'm complaining about now my circumstance. I'm complaining about the entire process which you got me from Egypt to here wasn't good enough. Yes, Jeff.
I was just looking in the lexicon. It was talking about this word in the cognate. In Arabic, means to moo lugubriously, like cattle.
That's an imagery. I'm sure of that. To moo like cattle. Moo. Cattle. Mooing like a cattle. That's a great imagery. That's great. This is you're complaining for the sake of complaining. You are trying to make your voice heard, and you're getting people to agree with you, commiserate with your problems, and all life is so hard on you, wah, wah, wah. But the problems have solutions. When God gives you the solution, accept the solution. These men accept the solution. The others didn't like the solution. They live it anyway. Doesn't like it much. Someone happened to die in the process. So there's a nature in the complaints for complaining. The people were seeking complaints. It points out, it says in verse 11, the people took to seeking complaints. They actually were looking for something to complain about on their first day out. So you're looking for complaints. You like the miserable thing. You want to be miserable and you want other people to be miserable with you. Because misery loves company, right? We know that statement for a reason.
Yeah.
It does. So we like complaints because we like to, more people to complain with us. When problems happen, we're looking for a solution, whatever the solution may be. Now, did Moses recognize the solution at first? Say, God, how's it going to help? There's not enough food to feed these people. They're going to fix the complaint. They keep complaining. I don't understand. God said, hey, none too short for me. I can do this. Just watch my power. We'll see what happens. So Moses may not have understood or envisioned the way in which the solution was going to come through, but he accepted whatever it was. And what did he do? He went to people and said, be prepared for tomorrow. God will take care of it. He didn't sit and express all of his doubt, saying, oh, God said he's going to do this, but he's not going to do it. This is just no way. He didn't say that. He trusted God and presented that, hey, God said this is how it is, how it's going to be fixed, whatever it may be, even though Moses could not understand how it was going to happen. But the solution came up, and he accepted the solution. Peter's complaint, I'm not going to eat this stuff. When the people showed up, they said, oh, now I get it. It wasn't about food, about human beings. Now I understand your solution. I understand what the issue is. At first he said no, because he was trying to envision what he saw, what he understood. Like Moses, what he understood. There isn't enough cattle for everybody. I see what I can see, but what I see isn't good enough. Because he didn't understand how God was going to do it. When he understood what he was going to do it and how he did it, then the solution worked. Meanwhile, the others who were complaining, seeking complaints, what God did to them? Yeah, not everybody, but they suffered. Many of them died. Because what were they after? They were seeking something to complain about. They wanted something to complain about. And the way to complain wasn't about food necessarily, though that was the pretext. It was about God and Egypt. They liked Egypt better. God didn't take kindly to that. And that's his issue. Hence, they passed. Let's move on. Let's see here. Okay. So, the leadership issue. So, God divvies up the people as far as how we're going to who does what and divvy up some of these complainers. So, I have to deal with all of them all the time, which is good for Moses. I'm going to swap this back. I like that. Okay, so let's erase this. So God goes, he says, all right, let's take a piece of what's inside of you, the gift I've given to you, and give these 70 elders, or 70 people, 70 elders, 70 judges. And I don't know if they're the exact same men that Jethro told him to collect together to deal with the troubles and disputes. Probably, but I don't know for certain. They probably are the same men because it's only been a year, roughly. About a year later, so it's probably the same group of guys that are selected to do this. But anyway, so God takes obviously a piece of Moses and separates or spreads it out. There's an issue or a symbolism behind that. Where do we get that same imagery from? Recall that imagery, the imagery of God taking a piece of a spirit inside of somebody and then distributing it out to others and spreading it out. There's a few of them, isn't there? There's a few of them, aren't there? God likes that imagery. He used it for Elijah and Elisha. He used it for the other ones. Obviously, the book of Acts, which is he used his own spirit to the people, the disciples. Yep. He used it for David and Saul. He actually took the spirit from Saul and gave it to David. Here, look what you said. He used it for... What else he used it for? What's it again? Yes, you're right. We have to Adam, which obviously spread through everybody else too. So yeah, that's a good example. So Adam too. Spread all mankind. And took piece of Eve too. That's true too. That's a physical way, but same idea. So this idea of taking from one and distributing it out, making it greater. Actually, this arrow is wrong way. Saul's here. Each of these examples, the recipients received more than the person he took it from. Right? So Elijah and Elisha did double. Well, he asked for a portion, but he did double portion. He had twice of everything, which is a good thing. That's a positive thing. He took from Elijah and gave it to him. So in the book of Acts, disciples, what'd they do? I forgot, was it 3,000 or 5,000? Is it 3,000 or 5,000? I can't remember. Was it 3? So 3,000. 3,000 people. I got 3. So they spread it. Okay, thanks God. I'll take that and I'll spread it out. Saul to David. Ah, that's a big one. What was Saul's? Well, spirit, it was the God was dwelling the spirit to give Saul comfort and difficulties. He was trying to work, not difficult, but help with difficulties to work through his kingship. When he gave it to David, what did David do with it? Spread out all of Israel, received it. David spread it to all of Israel. How did he do that? By becoming their king and savior. He just delivered them from all their enemies and problems and expanded his kingdom, had lots of great stuff, and of course that spreads out to his sons and such. Adam, of course, when Adam received the life from God, what did Adam do with it? He spread it to all mankind, and of course, obviously part of Eve was taken out of him as well, which that's how he did it through her. To spread to all mankind. So when God takes from one and he divides it up, what is he doing? He is increasing. See, we think of dividing things up as being smaller. Apparently God doesn't. We divide things up. Here's my piece of pie. Here's your sliver. Here's your crumb. So here's a piece of pie. Here's your 5 pieces of pie. Here's your 10 pies. Here's your bakery. It's a spreading out of increasing. He takes a little bit and makes it huge. That's the nature of what God's doing in all these stories. So when Moses comes along, and God says, okay, I'm going to take a piece of you, one man, I'm going to increase it or spread it to 70 men. What do the men then do? They all prophesy. Prophecy. BY, thank you. So they all prophesy. So in the nature of Moses, took one piece was part of him, and they spread out to 70 men, and they made them all, not all Moses, but they increased the size. And what was the response from Joshua? Arrest those men! What was Moses' response to Joshua then? He said, I'm not going to arrest these 2 guys. They're part of this. All these 68 others that are sitting here. I'm not going to arrest them. I'm not going to incarcerate them. What did I want? What is my goal? This isn't for people to glorify me, Moses, as any rather, all of God's people would be like this, receive God's Spirit. He would spread himself out to all of them, which, of course, over time, he does. But the point is, it's a process which God goes through. It's a continuing cycle.
Are you talking about the 2 men that didn't show up?
Yes, the 2 men that didn't show up. But not just, because those 2 were being arrested, because Joshua thought they should be arrested, because they were prophesying in the camp, and they weren't with Moses. And Moses pointed out, no, Joshua, you don't understand. I would rather that the entire camp be prophets. All of them. And then that beautifully introduces us to chapter 12. After the whole quail incident, the chapter 12. With Miriam and Aaron saying, hey, we're prophets too. Now they're all the same. Let's make a deal. Yeah, the deal is, we're in charge, you beat it. That was such the deal. I'm going to go over this for a minute. There's a TV show I think that did that a few years ago. I've forgotten the name of the TV. It's something like that anyway. So now we have all these spreading out and everybody gets all nice and happy. So now we have Miriam come on the scene. And Aaron. Now, these two people are not showing up in a bubble, meaning they're living within the experiences around them. So they see the 70 men who've had their experience as far as now they're prophesying to. They saw that the quail come. They saw the various things that God was doing, the various talkings, distributing his spirit out. They were understanding more and more and more. What stage people who understand more? What do? Yeah. They should be in charge. Oh, I can do this. That's not necessarily how God wants it. Maybe you can, maybe you should. That's God's decision, not ours. So in nature, we have people say, oh, wait, now I understand so much more than I ever knew before. That's great, wonderful, perfect, keep going. Let God decide what your job is, not you. What Miriam and Aaron do? Well, apparently, based on the instructions, it appears Miriam was the instigator, but it doesn't really matter. The point is, Miriam and Aaron, what did they try to do? They said, okay, they mumbled or murmured or went against Moses. Yeah, little brother, yeah. What does he know? He's a little kid. He's 84 years old. He's a little kid. Whatever, 82, whatever, I forgot his age. He's an old man now. But both of them are complaining against Moses. And of course, Does Moses hear their complaints? No, God does. So Moses is the one listening because they're complaining amongst themselves. Oh, look, mumble, 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 grumble, grumble, grumble. It's the nature of complainers. Moses doesn't hear it, God does. Of course, God calls all three of them out. Now, this complaint is an important one. Let's see. Yes. Yes, his wife. Yeah, this complaint is a particular type of complaint. The unlike the ones who are saying, hey, we like Egypt, or God, this is too much for me, take these people away, kill me now, it's not worth it. These were complaining specifically against Moses and his actions. So Moses' actions, in this case, was a Cushite woman, which today we call a Sudanese. Oh, that's Sudan, modern-day Sudan. Sudanese woman that he married. Now, we just got through in, what, chapter 10, I think it was, or 11, I can't remember. When Moses asks Hobab to come with him and travel along because he's father-in-law. So Moses already had, or has, I don't know if she's still alive or not, the other wife, which is, what's her name, Zipporah? Zipporah, right, thank you. She may have died, I'm not sure. Was it Zipporah? That was. Yeah, who was his first wife? His first wife was Zipporah, right? Jethro's daughter? Yeah, yeah. I don't know if she's dead or not. We don't know. It didn't say that she died. She was gone for a period of time and came back when a year earlier, a year ago, before this event, a year ago, Moses reconnects up with his father-in-law and receives his wife and his sons who are with, because she had, when Moses left the burning bush and went to Egypt, Zipporah, of course, does a circumcision detail and gets mad at him at the time. But when he's in Egypt, it appears, based on the accounts, that Zipporah and or her children, I don't know if her sons went with her or not, left Moses in Egypt for a period of time. And she hung out with her father-in-law in Midian or wherever she was hanging out. And when she came back, when they crossed the Red Sea, that Moses' father-in-law hooked up with him when they were given the Ten Commandments and reunited him with Zipporah and potentially his sons too. So, and that was roughly a year before this event, when, assuming these are loosely chronological, a year before this event, Miriam and Aaron are complaining. So Zipporah reunited about a year ago, and now he has a Sudanese wife, the Cushite woman. We do not know. There are like a million and one stories made up, all made up, about how Moses met and married the Cushite woman. I'm not going to tell you any of them. Because some of them are funny, but they're pointless. The point is, we don't know if Moses had two wives at the same time. Maybe Zipporah is dead now. We know nothing about it. Whatever the case may be is, he has two wives. Or at least he has a second wife. Now note, Moses is 80-some-odd years old. I don't know how old Zipporah was when he met her. And she may or may not be still alive. I have no idea. But either way, this event occurred. So Moses takes a second wife, the Cushite woman. And this is, of course, the complaint. Why are they complaining? What's wrong with the Cushite woman? What's wrong with the Sudanese woman? What was that? Say it again.
Foreign.
Ah. Is a Cushite or Sudanese woman, are they Israelites?
No.
No, they're not. Hence the name Cushite, yes. So, non-Israelite. Exactly. Neither was Zipporah. But what's the distinction about Zipporah that she had in her favor? She was from the land of, from the tribe of Midian, who are still descendants of Abraham, so still kind of in the family a little bit. Abraham's. So she was not an Israelite. Zipporah at least came from Midian. I don't know. He may or may not have, but that'd make a difference. So she was at least Midian. That's at least a descendant of Abraham, better than nothing. But the Cushite is completely not. So totally in every way and non-imaginable. So the issue they have is, most likely, she isn't one of us. She isn't a descendant of Abraham. She wasn't a descendant of anybody in Israel. You couldn't have chosen somebody better. You couldn't have chosen somebody else that was more properly fit for our people to be part of us. And why would they bring this up to her? Or up to him, sorry. Why is this issue a topic? Potentially thrown him, but there's something else going on. Yes, Daniel.
They had to marry within their own tribe?
You see, in Aaron's case, he said specifically the high priest. What does the high priest get to marry? High priest Aaron and all of his descendants as high priests and servants and people between man and God, as the servants are, you must marry an Israelite. That's the issue for Aaron. So, Miriam comes up, wait a minute, Aaron. So you, your children, granted, Aaron's probably happily married, all are supposed to follow this particular line of progression in selecting your wives, but Moses doesn't? Isn't that like a double standard? What's up with that? So, hence, she brings it up. She brings it up to him. So that was the most likely the issue with the terrible murder. As far as between Aaron and Moses and Miriam. So this is, the Israelite requirement for someone who is a servant of God is a terrible marker. I'll rewrite it. Darker marker. I like colors, if you haven't noticed. I know, I choose better colors. That's prettier. So Aaron has to choose an Israelite wife. But Moses, of course, does not. And Miriam, of course, didn't have to, though her was her husband, but that's a different story. As far as who she married. But the Israelite wife was required for Aaron, all the high priests. Well, who is the highest priest? Messiah. And Aaron's supposed to be his representative. Well, who does that make Moses? Well, God told Moses, I'll make you like a god to Pharaoh. So this makes this high priest requirement for Aaron and such. Moses over here is similar to, not that he is, but a representation of a godlike figure. Well, wouldn't God make a better representation of what is right and wrong? So God, what's wrong with you? You wouldn't do that, right? Well, that's the whole point. You're taking this godlike figure, your Moses, you're supposed to be like a godlike figure, because God said he would make you like a god, and you're living a life that is not as good or as holy, as righteous as Aaron, your older brother, who's supposed to be your servant. I don't understand. Moses, something's wrong with you. Hence, Miriam's complaint. So, why would Moses be allowed to do this, by the way, though?
God remarried us.
Ah, see, there's a difference between Aaron, Israel, the high priest, and God. Who are God's children? Everybody. Because who got made by him? Everybody. We're all God's children. We're all made in God, in his image. So God is not confined to say, I will only select Israelites as my children. As my they're my people, but his goal or objective was to take all the whole globe, not just one tribe and everybody else suffer and die. The point was take everybody. So in Moses' case, he actually did something that Aaron could never have done. He did something messianic. He took a rejected Gentile and brought her into, I'll draw it over here, into the house of Israel. Brought her by marrying him in the house of Israel. He took somebody who was rejected on the outside and brought her in. Well, the high priest isn't permitted to do such things, but God is. That was God's goal, to bring the outside and bring them in. That was the objective. That's how we got here. We're grafted in. We get adopted through, in that case, an adoption versus a marriage, but the same principle, as you're brought into the house of Israel. And so, technically, if you look at it symbolically or spiritually, her complaint isn't necessarily with Moses, isn't necessarily about the Cushite woman, or even necessarily about God. It's the idea of bringing an outsider into God's house or into God's dwelling place. That's the idea of rejecting somebody who doesn't belong. So what was God's solution to her? Which made her not belong. How do you like being rejected, Miriam? How do you like being on the outside, Miriam? You don't want the outside brought into you. Well, how about you live out there for a while and understand what this actually means to be a Gentile, to be outside the camp? It wasn't, because it was on purpose. So in this... close enough. Miriam's solution, whether she liked it or not, No, she was complaining. Here was his God's solution. She didn't necessarily like it. But her solution was, all right, Miriam, the Cushite woman normally is rejected because she's a Gentile. So now, live like a Gentile. You are now Gentile. How do you like it? Not very much. Well, the point is that she was contaminated. She was unclean. The reason Gentiles are kicked out is because they're unclean. They're not considered clean people. They're unclean people. Well, now she's giving tzarat, she became unclean. So because of your complaint, you don't want to be the unclean brought in. Let's put you as unclean and see what you do. See how you enjoy it. Was it pleasant? No, it wasn't. Was it devastating? Yes, it was. Now, does she understand what it means to be outside and kicked out? Yes. Does she now understand greater how important it is to bring those who are outside in?
Yes.
Solution? She had a complaint. And what happened? God gave her a solution. Here fixes your complaint. Guess what? It wasn't the way she wanted it done. She wanted the Cushite woman kicked out. It wasn't the way she wanted expected it to have happened or how the solution she wanted to have it to come to fruition. But that's the way God chose. And clearly, she accepted it. Because she got kicked out for 7 days. There wasn't a choice. Yeah, so just think about it. So she accepted the solution. All right? Does it make sense? Hopefully it makes sense. The nature of complaining is manifold. We want to go beyond just the complaint to complain, or for camaraderie, because misery loves company. We want to complain to find the problem, and or have the problem, and find the solution. And when you receive the solution, we have to accept it. Like it or not, we accept the solution. Does that make sense? It's the nature of complaints. How important are they? Does God like complainers? No. Does he have to deal with our problems? Yes. Do we have to accept the solutions to our problems? Yes. Do we like his solutions?
Not all the time.
Sometimes sure, sometimes not so good. Depends on how it works out. We don't understand it, but now Miriam no longer has an issue with Moses' wife, does she? Not at all. We're all probably good friends now. Make sense? Good. Any questions? Yes.
All right. Moses actually interceded on her behalf to get her cured, just like Messiah would.
Just like Messiah does. Hence, he's the... Did I erase it already? The messianic... I erased it already, didn't I? Oh, godlike. He used a messianic figure. So Moses, being the intercessor, which Aaron does too at different times later on, but the intercessor, he actually intercedes on her behalf to God, don't strike her. Basically, God, she didn't know what she was doing. She didn't know what she was doing. She didn't know what she was complaining about. Well, what did Messiah say on when he was dying? They don't know what they're doing. Yeah, they don't know what they're actually saying. They don't understand. Forgive them for it. So what's Moses saying? God, she doesn't really understand what she just did. She doesn't get the point. Forgive her of it. Get her past this problem. So it's the same idea of being that intercessor. So he, this godlike figure known as Moses, was a Messiah figure. A savior. Someone who was anointed. Someone who was selected to save or anoint. By just living out his life, he did it. Pretty impressive, actually. Any questions or comments? Hold on. Your hand was up first. Okay, that's a good question.
Okay, take that one. Okay.
Go ahead.
Why just Miriam and not Aaron?
Not Aaron, too. Ah, that goes back to... Did I erase it? I did, didn't I?
What are you talking?
I should stop erasing. I need 4 more boards. Okay, let me erase this real quick. I could. My previous diagram... You are a sinner hanging out here. What's Aaron's job? To stand there between God and you. If Aaron is contaminated as the high priest, as a sinner, what happens? Can he do his job anymore? No, he can't. So Aaron has a particular responsibility to not screw up. It's important. It's unique against him as a high priest. Now, if he was struck, what would have happened? Well, his son would have to do the job. And he would probably have a permanent scar from it. Because tzaraath, leprosy, leaves scars. What's God say? Blemishes? Unblemished? So if God chose and struck Aaron, I don't think Aaron instigated the complaint. Most likely Miriam instigated the complaint. Just my opinion. But If Aaron receives a scar from it, a permanent mark that identifies, I have been corrupted, I've been contaminated, leprosy leaves marks, it usually does. If I leave the mark, I am no longer fit to be in this unblemished category. Because Messiah is supposed to be unblemished, sin-free, no mistakes. So Aaron is supposed to be there and do his job. If God had struck him, most likely, because all leprosy usually does this, it would leave a scar or some kind of indicator that it was. Now, it points out that he looked at Miriam, so it was probably on her face, most likely, and potentially her hands. I'm not sure how much of her is uncovered. It's the desert, maybe less, more, who knows. How much it was obviously very visible for her. So Aaron would have been obviously very visible. Whatever scar was left would be permanently there and very visible to everyone. So Aaron would then no longer be high priest. His son would take over, and Aaron would be swept away, go do your job, go live your life. Your son Eleazar takes over. That was not God's intent. Because Aaron had other responsibilities God intended to do with him. So I don't think he was the instigator of it. Just my opinion. But if he was the instigator, we may have had a different story or some variations that I think would have been different. But he chose not to because this leaves permanent marks. And then he was no longer a good representation of Messiah anymore, of a blameless, perfect individual. Not that Aaron was perfect, but it's a symbolism, of course. Make sense? That's why I think it would be Miriam, not Aaron. Any questions or comments? Oh. Anything else? Yeah, actually, ending on time. Woohoo! Let's go close with a prayer. Almighty God, our great Heavenly Father, thank you for our Shabbat, our day of rest. The time to worship you, understand you, and see what is fair and just in your eyes and not ours. Father, help us to trust you and listen to your voice. Wherever you lead, wherever you dwell, may we always follow. May you always indwell within us, and may we always surround you. We trust you, Father, and ask your blessing the rest of our Shabbat and our time together. We praise you in Yeshua's name.
Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info.